Philippians chapter 2. Paul has so far in this letter displayed his love for the Philippians, his appreciation for their partnership in the gospel. He has acknowledged that they, like himself, are suffering because of the gospel, that they are facing opponents, persecution. Paul is in prison, and he says in chapter 1, I know that you are facing the same struggle that you see me facing. So they are like Paul in this conflict, wanting to be faithful, but facing the pressures of a world that does not want to hear the gospel for the most part. But they are being faithful. At the same time, Paul recognizes that there is disunity and division lurking to divide the church. And the letter itself gives some evidence of some of that disagreement, even though we don't know what the disagreements are. And so in chapter 2, verses 1 and following, he charges them to be of one mind and one spirit, to show true humility. And that the source for the power to live that way is the mind of Christ. And then he breaks into this beautiful hymn, if you will, about how Jesus gave up, emptied himself, and took on the form of a servant, being found in human likeness, and became obedient to death, even death on a cross. And that because of that, God has exalted him. And that he has been given the name Lord and Lord of all. And that one day every knee will bow and every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. Then Paul has given us in chapter 2, verses 12 through 18, therefore, my beloved, since you've always obeyed, not only as in my presence, but much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. Do all things without grumbling or questioning. Two immediate ways of putting the mind of Christ to work. He now provides two models of living with the gospel priority. He provides two profiles, two lives, if you will, that exemplify this expendable living. We all know the importance of example. In fact, if you do a search online, you will find scads of inspirational quotes about example or imitation. Let me give you just a couple that I found. First is this one by Albert Schweitzer. Example is not the main thing in influencing others. It is the only thing. That's not entirely true. But he's making a point. Maybe you like this one. Few things are harder to put up with than the annoyance of a good example. A little more cynical, maybe a little more realistic for many of us. A good example is far better than a good precept. That's Dwight L. Moody. That was Mark Twain before, of course. Dwight L. Moody, American evangelist. Example is the most powerful rhetoric. Thomas Brooks, who was a Puritan pastor. You'll find many, many, many quotes on example because we all know how important example is. But it is also a biblical truth. It's a biblical concept. In 1 Corinthians 11, verse 1, Paul writes, "Be imitators of me, even as I am of Christ." In 1 Timothy 4:12, he tells Timothy, "Let no one despise you for your youth, but set the believers an example in speech, in conduct, in love, in faith, in purity." 2 Timothy 3:10, "You, however, have followed my teaching, my conduct, my aim in life, my faith, my patience, my love, my steadfastness." And even here in Philippians chapter 3, verse 17, he will say, "Brothers, join in imitating me and keep your eyes on those who walk according to the example you have in us." Modeling takes place all the time. takes place all the time, whether you're conscious of it or not. And every one of us could point to someone's example that has significantly affected who we are. This is true whether the example was good or whether the example was bad. And most of us, at some point or another, have known both good examples and bad examples. Parenting, of course, is the most visible and influential modeling anyone can do. Children will talk like their parents, walk like their parents, think like their parents, share their parents' prejudices. And so this emulating, this imitating, this following an example is crucial for spiritual maturity and faithfulness, just as it is crucial for parents to model, to provide examples for children. That old saying, that old cliche, do as I say, not as I do. We all recognize the hypocrisy that that is. Imitating is crucial to maturity and faithfulness. This is why young men and young women need godly parents, first of all, and why they need more than just peers. They need mentors. They need disciplers, or whatever other term we might use for it. It is why young couples need older couples to watch and spend time with and see, talk, and resolve disagreements and know their stories and know what they've been through. It is why seminaries and other theological training institutions cannot produce godly pastors and leaders. They can only educate them. It takes the church to model. It takes the church to give example. I know in my own life that it was the example of a man that finally drew me into pursuing ministry full time. I was actually living up here in this area, working at a Bible camp full time, wrestling with God's call in my life and whether or not I wanted to go on into more formal. I have my college degree. Do I want to go on into more formal theological training? Do I want to go to seminary? What does this look like? Do I want to do this? I knew that God had called me to an ivory tower. And it was when a pastor that I admired, that I thought was a good example of who a pastor should be, said to me, what are you planning to do with your life? What are you planning to go from here? And I told him my struggle, and he said, I think you should do that. And if you come down to seminary, down to LA, if you come to the master seminary, I'd like for you to come and be an intern in the college ministry where I pastor. That was the key turning point for me. Because I knew that seminary could not impact my life. Just intuitively, I knew that could educate me, and I wanted that. But I needed to sweat with God's people, bleed with God's people, weep with God's people, and seminary was not going to provide that. And if someone was going to look at me and say, I'll take you, and you can come with me to be with God's people and learn what it means to pastor, that for me lit it up, and that's a large reason why I went to seminary. It's because someone opened the door of mentoring for me and example. Now, Paul points to himself as an example as he seeks to imitate Christ. He is even being poured out like a drink offering for the Philippians' faith. It means he's being expired, he's being expended for their faith. But Paul can't be there. Paul can't be in Philippi. And so you will see that Paul repeats the word send in these verses. Paul is sending to the Philippians two examples, two men with whose lives are familiar to the Philippians, whose lives model what it looks like to live sacrificially for the gospel. They are Timothy and Epaphroditus. And we see in their lives four qualities that model radical self-sacrifice. Four qualities that model radical self-sacrifice. And the first is Timothy. I send to you Timothy. Timothy is presented in verse 19, chapter 2. I hope in the Lord Jesus to send Timothy to you soon, so that I too may be cheered by news of you. For I have no one like him who will be genuinely concerned for your welfare. For they all seek their own interests, not those of Jesus Christ. But you know Timothy's proven worth, how as a son with a father he has served with me in the gospel. I hope therefore to send him just as soon as I see how it will go with me. And I trust in the Lord that shortly I myself will come also. Now, Timothy is Paul's closest associate, whom Paul refers to in his letters as his son in the faith. One reason for Timothy's mission to Philippi is to gather news about the Philippian Christians and report to Paul how things are going there. In truth, how they have responded to this letter. But he's not sending Timothy immediately. He first wants to see how things go with him, which I think we would understand to be, Paul wants to see the verdict come down. He's in prison. He's awaiting trial. He wants to see whether or not the verdict will free him or execute him before he sends Timothy. So Paul himself plans to come to Philippi. But what he's envisioning then is before he leaves, once the verdict has been given, before he leaves, he will send Timothy on ahead. Timothy will go to Philippi, see how things are there, return to Paul before Paul himself sets out, and so that Paul will get news. And he anticipates good news. He anticipates being cheered by the Philippians' ready response to this letter. Timothy is someone Paul trusts to assess the situation in Philippi and encourage them and to model for them the very things that he writes in this letter. What does Timothy exemplify? Well, first he exemplifies genuine concern. Genuine concern. I hope to send Timothy soon. Why Timothy? Because I have no one like him. I have no one like him. That is, of everyone partnered with me in this gospel work, the most mature, the most ready, the best suited is Timothy. Timothy is outstanding. Paul is saying, I have no one else who can represent me like Timothy can. No one else who models my own priorities and my convictions and my concern for you like Timothy does. And so I know that when I send Timothy, he will be genuinely concerned for your welfare. And this word genuine or true, sometimes it's translated, was used in the context of family relationships to identify someone as a valid member of a family. So you might say it means he's legitimate. He's true. He's real. You guys belong together. Timothy's concern for the Philippians is real. It's not artificial. It's not just put on. His concern for the Philippians is natural. It's not forced. It's quick to respond. Not hesitant and calculating. His concern is open and transparent. It's not filled with caveats and conditions. He genuinely cares for their welfare. In short, Timothy mirrors Paul's concern and care. He represents Paul's own warmth and concern for the Philippian believers. And he's able to do this because he seeks the interests of Jesus Christ. You notice that? Timothy seeks the interests of Jesus Christ, not his own interests. And surprisingly, Timothy's selflessness, his selfless mindset, is in short demand, because according to verse 21, the reason Paul has no one like him is because they all seek their own interests, not those of Jesus Christ. But who is they all who seek their own interests? We know that Paul had a number of associates in his ministry who were faithful and trustworthy. What about Titus? What about Silas? What about Tychicus, Apollos, Luke, Silvanus? Where are these guys? They are always mentioned in Paul's letters with praise and confidence. Well, if you turn back to Philippians chapter 1, I think we can piece it together this way. Turn back to Philippians chapter 1 and look again at verse 14. Paul's in prison, and he's explaining to the Philippians that this is God's, God is using this. This has turned out for the advancement of the gospel. Philippians 1:14, and most of the brothers, having become confident in the Lord by my imprisonment, are much more bold to speak the word without fear. So the gospel is spreading throughout the household of Caesar. It's apparent to everybody here why I'm in here, who I love, the God I worship, the Lord Jesus that I preach and proclaim, but it's also emboldening others to preach the gospel. Verse 15, some indeed preach Christ from envy and rivalry, but others from goodwill. The latter do it out of love, knowing that I am put here for the defense of the gospel. The former proclaim Christ out of rivalry, not sincerely, but thinking to afflict me in my imprisonment. What then? This is his response. Only that in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is proclaimed, and in that I rejoice. So I think this is the situation. There are these two groups. There are those who preach Christ out of goodwill and love. They have been emboldened by Paul's imprisonment. Then there are those who are preaching Christ out of rivalry. Their gospel is pure, or Paul would not condone it. He would not be rejoicing. Their message is clear, and it is right about Christ and the cross. But their motives are rivalry, meaning that it would seem that they are trying to kind of horn in on Paul's ministry. They're in some ways, they're trading on his name, but trying to kind of take over the authority or the reputation that Paul has in some way. And so there is this spirit of rivalry and self-interest in their preaching of the gospel. And what I take from these verses then in chapter 2 is that those who preach Christ out of love and goodwill are not on hand. They're not available to go to Philippi. Maybe they're out on other assignments. But they're not available. The only ones on hand happen to be at least a few of this other group. And though Paul may rejoice that Christ is being preached, even from pretense, even from false motives, even though he may be happy to set aside his own ego and his own reputation for the gospel's sake, he can't send any of these guys to Philippi. They're not qualified. They're not qualified because they're consumed with their own interests, not Christ's. Except Timothy. Timothy is there. He's the one associate, part of this team, preaching the gospel, ministering to Paul. He's the one guy who's there, who is not looking out for his own interests. Where are the other trustworthy associates? Don't know. But Timothy's the only one on hand who is of proven worth. So, genuine concern. This is the quality that Paul sets forth that ought to be followed and imitated. A kind of concern for others that doesn't have its own interests in mind, but the welfare and interests of other people. Now, Timothy's proven worth leads us to our second quality, and that's gospel loyalty. Gospel loyalty. Look at verse 22. But you know Timothy's proven worth, how as a son with a father, he has served with me in the gospel. The Philippians know Timothy is trustworthy because he's family to Paul. Paul appeals here to the common ancient practice of fathers training their sons as apprentices in their trade. If you were a fisherman, your son, even at a young age, would accompany you on the boat. He would learn the ins and outs of fishing. Not only the skills of knowing where the fish were, how to drop the nets, how to mend the nets, what times of the day to go and not go, depending on the season, but he would also learn the business of fishing. Who do you sell fish to? How much are they worth at this time of the year versus other seasons, and so on and so forth. And he would have learned that trade from a young age. If you were a builder, you would have taken your son with you, and he would have learned the building trade. Not only how to build, but how to be a contractor, if you will. How to make that his livelihood. If you were a shepherd, your son would be out there in the fields with you. He would understand where to take the sheep, where not to take them, when to shear them, when to sell them, when one was sick, how to care for them, so on and so forth. He would do that. This is why we call Jesus a carpenter. It's because, not because the scriptures ever tell us Jesus was a carpenter, but because it tells us Joseph was a carpenter. And because Joseph was a carpenter, we understand that in that world, Jesus would have taken on the trade of his father. And so Jesus would have been a carpenter. Of course, this is very different from our day and culture. If you're an engineer at Boeing, your children probably don't go with you to work and sit in your office and watch you send email or whatever you do. Whatever you engineers do. I'm about as far from an engineer as you can get. Or a software developer. Or a nurse. Our children just don't accompany. Our culture's different, and there are probably pros and cons to that. Timothy is like a son from a father has learned the gospel ministry from Paul. Timothy is not only proven a loyalty, watch, not only a loyalty to the priority of gospel preaching, but he has learned and taken on and imitated a loyalty to the priority of the gospel and how he casts self-interest aside for Christ's interests and others' welfare. That's the extent to which Timothy's life has taken on the example of his father in the faith, Paul. And so Paul knows that when he sends Timothy, he's sending whom? Himself. Now these others that Paul refers to may be part of Paul's gospel mission, traveling with him, trading on his name, but they do not have the relationship with Paul. They do not have this closeness to him that has observed his humility, his expendability, and emulated him like Timothy. Timothy's the only one there. And he has this loyalty to the gospel, not just staying in the truth and doctrine, but a loyalty to the gospel that comes out, that expresses itself in a casting aside of his own interests and cares for others. Timothy has done this, and that's why Paul can say to Timothy in 2 Timothy 3:10, "You have followed my teaching, my conduct, my aim in life, my faith, my patience, my love, my steadfastness. You've seen it all, Timothy. You've been there all of this time. And in 2 Timothy, of course, Paul is saying, I'm going to die soon. And you're going to have to carry this example forward. That fact uniquely qualifies him for the mission to Philippi. Again, this highlights the need for relationship and ministry training and the need for relationship in the Christian walk. In Titus 2, when Paul wants young men to lead self-controlled, godly lives, what does he do? He calls on the older men to train them by exemplifying what it means to live self-controlled, sober, godly, upright lives. And he calls on the older women to train, that's the word, train younger women in godliness and in priorities in life. Why? Because Paul knows that it's not enough for Titus to get up and preach the gospel, to teach classes, to install elders, but that in the life of the church, in the life of the people of God, there must be this ongoing example that godliness must be modeled. It has to be seen. So this proven loyalty to the gospel then, and its priority over self-interest, this is a quality in someone that we are to emulate, that we're to imitate. To see that model, someone who's loyal to the gospel, not only in doctrine, though that, of course, is necessary, not only in doctrine, but understands that by believing the gospel and living out the gospel, there must be an expendability. There must be this casting off of self-interest and a whole giving of the life to Jesus Christ's interests and the interests of others. This is a quality to emulate. The second model of radical self-sacrifice is Epaphroditus. Epaphroditus, and like Timothy, we see two characteristics of this radical sacrifice. Epaphroditus is presented in verse 25. I have thought it necessary to send to you Epaphroditus, my brother and fellow worker and fellow soldier, and your messenger and minister to my need. For he has been longing for you all and has been distressed because you heard that he was ill. Indeed, he was ill, near to death, but God had mercy on him, and not only on him, but on me also, lest I should have sorrow upon sorrow. I am the more eager to send him, therefore, that you may rejoice at seeing him again and that I may be less anxious. So receive him in the Lord with all joy and honor such men, for he nearly died for the work of Christ, risking his life to complete what was lacking in your service to me. Let's talk about Epaphroditus for a moment. Epaphroditus is from Philippi. Paul recognizes him as the Philippians' messenger and minister to my need. So he is the Philippian church's emissary to Paul in prison. And what Epaphroditus has done, first of all, is he has delivered financial support for Paul to make sure that all of his needs are met, as well as carried greetings and affection from the believers in Philippi. Paul, a number of times in the letter, especially at the end, mentions this gift, that it has supplied his needs, that he's overwhelmed and grateful for what the Philippians have done, their generosity to him. That's part of their partnership in the gospel, partly how they have expressed it. Secondly, Epaphroditus brings to Paul in prison a report on how things are with the believers in Philippi. He describes to Paul the persecution that they are suffering. He informs Paul of the disagreements of among some of them. He tells Paul of their concern for Paul, including the result of his imprisonment. Paul, the folks back home, they're wondering, Do you think you're going to be acquitted in your trial? Do you think that they've seen you for the last time, and this is going to lead to your execution? They're concerned about you. And they're wondering if God is doing something here, moving you out of ministry. This is why part of the reason Paul responds with, no. My imprisonment is advancing the gospel. Don't think for a moment that the gospel ministry is somehow being suppressed or choked out here. But Epaphroditus brings these things to Paul from Philippi. And Paul here describes him with high praise. He is a brother. By that, he doesn't mean just a fellow believer. This speaks of an affectionate relationship. Now, I don't know if Paul knew Epaphroditus when Paul had been in Philippi before, and so this is kind of a reunion for him when Epaphroditus shows up from Philippi. I don't know if this is the first time Paul has ever met Epaphroditus. But in any case, and for however long Epaphroditus has been there in prison with Paul, they have formed an affectionate relationship. Paul calls him a brother, calls him a fellow worker. He has shared the burden of ministry with Paul, instructing, counseling, communication, making sure communication happened between Paul and other leaders and so on, and whatever other things he might have been doing, maybe preaching, late nights in study, early mornings in prayer. Epaphroditus has participated in all of these things. He's a fellow worker. He's also a fellow soldier, which means that Paul thinks of Epaphroditus as someone who's been in the trenches with him. And especially, he has endured opposition, persecution with Paul for the gospel's sake. He's a brother, he's a fellow worker, and he is a fellow soldier. And yet, despite Epaphroditus' closeness and faithfulness, Paul finds it necessary to send him back to Philippi. Which means it is Epaphroditus who has carried and now delivered this letter from Paul to the Philippian church. He has sent Epaphroditus back with this letter saying, I'm going to send Timothy, and then I intend to follow Timothy, come back myself once Timothy has brought a report to me. So it's these circumstances then that Paul highlights these qualities in Epaphroditus that model sacrifice. And here's the first one, seasoned suffering. Seasoned suffering. Verse 26 explains why it was necessary for Epaphroditus to return. He has been longing for you all and has been distressed because you heard he was ill. As you're reading this, you've got to keep in mind that there are none of the conveniences of modern communication. I don't just mean email and Skype or FaceTime. I mean telephones, telegraphs. There's none of that. It's Pony Express. It's you send a letter. He is distressed because you heard that he was ill. Epaphroditus is longing for the relationships back home, but specifically because he knows that they are aware that he has been sick. So it's concern for their possible fears and sorrow that have bothered him. You notice he's not distressed because he was ill. He's distressed because he knows that they know that he was ill. And that may have caused for them distress and sorrow. It seems to me from Paul's words here that communication was murky on both sides. The Philippians didn't really know all the details about Epaphroditus' illness. They had maybe even received mixed reports. Epaphroditus is really ill. He's close to death. They may have received reports that he had died. They also may have received reports that it wasn't very serious. But Epaphroditus and Paul couldn't be sure what they knew or didn't know about Epaphroditus' illness. And so they're left with, well, do they think I'm dead? Do they know I've been on my deathbed, but I'm still alive? Or maybe they think I wasn't really that sick at all. And if I show up, Paul, and they don't know that I've been seriously ill, are they going to understand why I've come back? So Paul clarifies this point. Indeed, he was ill, near to death. But like every life, Epaphroditus' life was in God's hands, and God had mercy on him. God spared Epaphroditus' life and restored him to health. It was mercy to Epaphroditus, Paul says, and it was mercy to Paul, because Epaphroditus dying would have caused him sorrow upon sorrow. We see Paul in his vulnerability, don't we? Yes, Paul rejoiced in the gospel. Yes, Paul had an eternal mindset. And yes, Paul would have felt sorrow upon sorrow if Epaphroditus had died. And as Paul recognizes the sorrow that it would have caused himself, he quickly empathizes with the Philippian situation. That's why he says, I was eager to send him. It's for their joy and to relieve his anxiety over their possible anxieties. Paul is careful to emphasize that Epaphroditus is not a shirker. He has not abandoned Paul. He has not abandoned the mission. Rather, his bout with this deadly illness proves Epaphroditus' willingness to endure. This is partly why Paul clarifies what has happened. Because the Philippians have sent Epaphroditus probably with enough funding of his own that he can live with Paul and stay with Paul and be freed up from having to work, find a job, whatever, just to help Paul. And I'm sure that the Philippian church, when they did this, and Paul needs help, Paul's in prison, he's already been there a while, we need to send somebody. And I'm sure they had a few candidates. And whatever process they used, they came to the decision of Epaphroditus. They said, here's what we're going to do. We're going to take up a collection. And they generously gave. And they had a fund. And they said, Epaphroditus, part of this fund is to sustain you. You go, you live with Paul, you help Paul. And you stay as long as he needs you. We can't all go. We can't all go serve. We would if we could, but you represent us. In some ways, that's what's happening this Thursday with the trip to India. Pastor Scott and Roberta and Frank and the rest of the team, they in ways represent us, our care, our concern, which is genuine. Who among you, when you see pictures of those kiddos in Nagaland, would not want to scoop them up in your arms? You would. And when our team scoops them up, they're scooping them up for us, right? So, this is what the Philippians have done. They have sent Epaphroditus. Now what? So here comes Epaphroditus. What are you doing back here? We had heard you were ill, but we didn't think it was that serious. And then others are going, we thought you'd died. It's good to see you back. Paul clarifies what's going on. And what he wants them to understand is that the fact that Epaphroditus has returned is proof that he is seasoned in suffering. Epaphroditus has known what it means to go out for the mission of the gospel, to get ill, to fight death, and stick with it. I decided to send Epaphroditus back. It was my choice, my call, and he's longed for you because he's been concerned about you, not because he had any trepidation about staying on with me and continuing the work of the ministry here. If you're going to look for a model, you want someone who has suffered. You want someone who has faced hardship and not crumpled, not walked away. You want someone who has walked through cancer, not shiny and happy, but praising God even from the pits of despair. You want a model who has been abandoned by their spouse, but instead of bitterness, trusts in God's goodness, even though it tears them up inside. When you want to when you want to follow an example, you want someone who wrestles with depression or loneliness and takes Jesus' hand to walk through it. And it's shown that they do that. You want someone seasoned in the fires of suffering. If you're going to trek through the mountains, you want a guide who hasn't shaved and smells like a campfire. If you're going into battle, you want an officer who has a scarred face and bloodstains on his uniform. And if you're going to follow Christ, you want a Christian who speaks of deep valleys, dark hours, and the glory of God's love that would not let them go. You want someone who counts the cross as a daily pleasure. You want someone who's lost a job because they wouldn't compromise the gospel. You want to follow someone who exemplifies these things. You do not want Joel Osteen. You do not want church leaders who suddenly decide to allow homosexual pastors in contradiction to God's truth. They're not willing to stand up for the truth, even when it hurts, when it makes you unpopular. You want to follow John Bunyan. You want to follow Richard Wurmbrand. You want to follow those who are seasoned in suffering. You want someone tested and proven. You want to emulate someone like Epaphroditus, whose response to almost dying is to think of others' welfare and sparing them concern and sorrow. What kind of priorities motivated Epaphroditus? The gospel priority, which Paul goes on to point out. And last we see ready sacrifice. Ready sacrifice. So Epaphroditus exemplifies seasoned suffering. And he exemplifies ready sacrifice. Verse 29. So receive him in the Lord with all joy and honor such men. Don't be suspicious of him. Don't raise an eyebrow, right? I wonder. Receive him in the Lord with all joy and honor such men, for he nearly died for the work of Christ, risking his life to complete what was lacking in your service to me. This is how such models of sacrifice should be received, with joy, honor. Was it possible that the Philippians would question why Epaphroditus had returned prematurely? Maybe. That's possible. And that's why Paul says, receive him with joy. Maybe Paul wants to ensure that no one questions his faithfulness here. They should rejoice at his return. Honor him. It may also be this. It may also be, so to put myself in that place, it may also be that Epaphroditus struggled with returning. It may be that Epaphroditus, though he's concerned for his beloved friends back in Philippi, that he longs for them, that he felt guilty. Perhaps he felt like he wasn't completing his assignment. And so Paul writes this to the church for Epaphroditus' encouragement, for Epaphroditus to hear this letter explain to his family and friends in Philippi, receive him with joy, honor men like him. He almost gave his life for the gospel. Honor Epaphroditus. Emulate his example. So I'm going to send you Timothy. He represents me. Genuine concern, gospel loyalty, and casting aside his own interests. And you know Epaphroditus, he's one of your own. Emulate his example. Why? For he nearly died for the work of Christ, risking his life to complete what was lacking in your service to me. You couldn't all come. You couldn't serve. You felt there was a lack there, so you sent Epaphroditus to represent. Because Epaphroditus was entirely expendable for the gospel. No, Epaphroditus did not contract his illness from hostile persecution. But taking on such a mission as this, the travel, the wear and tear, made a person vulnerable in their health and in their safety. We see this portrayed in Paul's own missions in the book of Acts, where Paul is out as a missionary and he ends up shipwrecked on islands. He ends up being beaten. He ends up being hungry. He ends up being stoned. So all of these things happen to Paul. When you went on mission, you went risking, from our perspective, risking. You went saying, my own health, my own safety may be jeopardized in these situations. And Epaphroditus has done this. In other words, Epaphroditus would not have had this bout with death if he had chosen the comforts of his living room in Philippi. If he had said, you know, guys, this is really an honor that you're sending me to Philippi, but I mean, sending me from Philippi when you're sending me to Paul in prison, but you know, I've got a lot of things going on. I got a cold. I got some shows to watch this week. Epaphroditus left the comforts of home, made his life vulnerable. He put his life at risk, and he nearly paid the price. Like Timothy, Epaphroditus has put first the interests of Jesus Christ. This is a quality to follow. Now, I want you to notice something in these descriptions of these two men, Timothy and Epaphroditus. You will notice these phrases, seek own interests, the interests of Jesus Christ. Verse 21, what does that sound like? Back up in chapter 2, verse 4. Look not only to your own interests, but to the interests of others. What about this serve? Timothy has served. What did Jesus do? He took on the form of a servant. Same word. And Epaphroditus has had a bout with death. He has almost died. What was the ultimate proof of Jesus' selflessness? He became obedient to death. What's Paul saying? He's saying these two men, Timothy and Epaphroditus, exemplify Jesus. In essence, if I could sum up these two paragraphs, Paul says, follow and imitate people who imitate Jesus. That's what Paul says about himself. Imitate me as I imitate Christ. And who are those who imitate Jesus? Those who work out the mind of Christ. Now, the meaning for us is twofold. First, we need to find right examples. We need to find right examples. We need to identify them. And we need to somehow get close to them. We need to watch them. We need to hear from them. They're not going to be perfect. Nobody's perfect. Timothy's not perfect. Epaphroditus wasn't perfect. Paul is not perfect. But they're on the path. And they're moving forward down the path. And whoever that is ahead of me. And whoever it is ahead of you. We need to find the right examples. That's why Paul is writing this to the Philippians. He has talked about his own life. I'm being poured out like a drink offering. My life is entirely expendable for the gospel. even against rival preachers and so on. All that, all that they do, all of the rivalry, the competition that they created. Paul's saying, my life is expendable. And then he looks at Jesus and he says, Jesus' life is the, not only the model, but the source. We have to go to the cross. We find the ability, the capacity to live like Jesus in Jesus by having the mind of Christ, which is already ours in him because we belong to him. Now Paul turns and he says, I'm sending two men to you. One just arrived with this letter. He's Epaphroditus. And all of the circumstances that bring him back to you prove his worthiness of being a model and an example. Think about what he just did, almost dying for the sake of the gospel. He's a model. Follow him. Pattern your life. When you read this letter, look at Epaphroditus. And I'm going to send you Timothy. Timothy has matured. He's like a son to me in the faith. He's learned the gospel ministry. He's taken it on. He's going to exemplify it. Watch those two men. We need to find the right examples. And we need to be the right examples. That's right. We need to be the right examples. You say, oh, hold on. Sean, it sounds so arrogant. It sounds so overconfident for me to say that I'm an example. There is always someone right behind you. There's always people in front of you in their growth in Christ and their understanding of what it means to pour out their lives like drink offerings for the sakes of others and for the gospel. There are always those ahead of you. But there are always some behind you. Younger believers, whether the younger in age or younger in the faith, you're to be an example. And the further you go, the more there will be behind you, further back behind you, who are watching you, to whom you should be able to say with that salt of humility, I'm following Christ. Follow me. You spend time with me. You're floundering. You're struggling. Let's go hang out. We don't have to do formal Bible study, though it might be part of it. We don't have to read books, though it might be part of it. But you spend time in my home. You spend time in my dorm room. You spend time wherever, in these places, in these ways, you watch my life. I don't have all the answers, but I got enough of the answers. Find the right examples, and we need to be the right examples. And if you think about the fact that there are other believers who are not as far down the path of Christian growth and maturity as you are, is that not a motivation to keep moving? If you are a parent, have been a parent, are you not more motivated because you know little eyes are watching you? Things that you used to do and you're suddenly very conscious of? I'm setting an example here. I might have the freedom to do that, but what my example might communicate to my son or my daughter, that's got to go. That's got to go. Same thing in the Christian life. There are believers watching you. And that ought to be a motive to be the right example. There are other believers that you're setting a pattern for, whether you're conscious of it or not. But you should be conscious of it, because I'm telling you right now that you are. We need to find the right examples. We need to be the right example.